This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our program Main Street because our microphones create this Main Street for all of our listeners across the state this time of day. And of course, when we're stepping across the real ones, we say hello to each other and talk about what's on our minds. And today it might be the weather. It's hot. It's September. It's been a dry summer. That's a perfect entree to talk with our horticulturist, Ron Smith, who joins us regularly to talk about lawn and garden care. Ashley Thornburg with me. And, of course, you out there are invited to join in.
And it is easy to do. You can pick up the phone and call 888-755-6377. Again, 888-755-6377, or send us an email, mainstreet@prairiepublic.com. Ron, thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I think we should probably lead with drought conditions.
Absolutely. Yes, we aren't suffering what Houston and other southern parts of Texas have gone through. I wish they would have been able to get some of that water to come up this way. But we've been going through a very severe drought, and both the lawns and our woody plants and herbaceous perennials are suffering from it. Now, you might look at your lawn and say, yeah, my lawn actually really looks pretty lousy. I think people need to make a decision at this time as to whether or not they want their lawn to go into complete dormancy. And complete dormancy is as brown as this tabletop that we're sitting at. That doesn't mean the grass is dead. It just means it's gone into a protective stage for about 3 or 4 weeks. And hopefully it'll get some moisture. If we don't get moisture and we have high temperatures and no rain at all during that 3 or 4 week period, you need to go ahead and give it about a quarter of an inch of water once a week to keep the crown of the grass plant alive. Now, if brown is not your color, then go ahead and irrigate if it's legal in your community to do so on a regulated basis, where you can go ahead and put down about an inch to an inch and a half of water every week to keep the grass growing quite well. The other thing to keep in mind is try to look at the environment from the grass's perspective. Grass being mowed during the hot part of the day doesn't like it. It's not going to respond well. And I've seen situations where people have gone out and mowed their grass in the late afternoon, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a 90-degree day, and they call me back in a week or so saying, what's going on with my lawn? And it'll have these stripes going across it and maybe even some footprints. Well, they mowed their lawn when the grass was bone dry, and that killed or left these tire tracks from the lawnmower.
Uh-huh.
And it'll eventually recover if they get some water to it. If it doesn't, it's just going to look – you have to put up with it looking pretty bad.
Well, we've already got a call,
Ron. Oh, good. That's great.
Let's hear from Donovan in Regan.
Hi.
Hello, Ron.
Yes, this is Ron.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm calling about – I have some questions about fruit trees.
Okay.
We have a pear tree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's 20 years old. It just finally started blooming, producing last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we got quite a few pears this year.
Mm-hmm.
There is a – it's got a fork about a foot off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that is – if I should be cutting off part of that. The rabbit's got to one branch of it, but it, you know, it's trying to heal itself.
Yeah. Good old rabbits, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it a wide – okay, I'm going to ask you, you say it has a fork. Is it a V-shaped fork or is it a U-shaped fork? In other words, is it kind of a smooth or is it at a very, very sharp angle? That would
more of a V-shape.
More of a V-shape. Eventually that will weaken unless you do something to prop it up. You can either cable it or brace it one way or the other, you know, through rods or cabling because that will – as it ages, continues to age. Now, you had it, you said 20 years?
Yeah, I think at least that long.
Okay, and you haven't had any problems with it up to this point, right?
No, we're not. We'll lose a few branches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It depends. I've seen trees like that be around for a long time, and then when they get a good fruit load, bingo, and a little bit of a wind, that's when the crotch of that V-shape there splits. And so if it's important for you to keep it, then keep it to get the maximum production from the tree. If it's not important, then you're not going to lose too much fruit production from removing the weaker of the two branches, then go ahead and remove it. If it's bigger around than your wrist, I would say I'd think twice before you go ahead and remove it.
Okay, yeah, it's probably 2 or 3 inches.
Diameter. Yeah, I would say it probably has a pretty good attachment there. The thing I would wait or try to observe as much as possible, as a fruit load starts coming on earlier in the year, or even at this time, have you harvested any pears yet?
Yeah, they've all come off now.
Oh, they all have come off. Okay, good. Then you got through the harvest season.
The hard part. Huh?
The hard part without any trouble.
Delicious part.
Yeah, but I just continue to watch it because as the tree continues to get old, just like as we continue to get old, we get weaker and weaker. And
can you prop that branch up?
Yes, you can prop it up, or you can go ahead and put a cable there. Just get a bolt drilled through the upper part of those two branches and tighten it up, and that'll give it a little bit of support. So, yeah, I think you're okay.
Did you have another question?
Yeah, I got an apricot tree that we lost about half of it in the snow from the wind and the drifts caving in. And should I be trimming that up as close as I can to the...
Yeah, get rid of the dead stuff, you mean?
The trunk, yeah.
Yeah, I would. Go ahead and make clean cuts on it. It's not going to hurt anything to do it this time of year. If you leave the dead wood there, it's just going to be a place for snow to accumulate, and it'll probably break off anyway. You would be better off to be the one that removes the dead wood than having Mother Nature do it. She won't be as neat as you.
Okay.
Okay.
And last question.
Sure.
When do I pick my apples?
When do you pick your apples?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, depends on the apple. If it's State Fair, it's too late. If it's any other variety, like Hail Red, I would say go by the color. You can cut an apple open, and if the seed is very, very dark brown, almost black, then it's probably ripe. And, of course, what's the ultimate test for picking apples?
Taste.
Taking a bite.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. If it tastes good, go ahead and harvest.
All right.
Okay.
Sample it.
Yeah, sample it. Like we do with wine, right? No, the wine is ready to be bottled.
Thank you, Donovan.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Enjoy talking with you.
I learned something that I want to just follow up on here. The shape of the branch's connection to the main stem tells you something about the strength of the branch. Huh?
Yep.
You were talking about a U shape.
Or you're going to have a weak connection right here. Mm-hmm. If it's U shape, you're going to have a good, strong connection that's going to be able to be self-supporting.
All right.
Yep.
The stuff we learn. Talking to a horticulturist.
And the number to call that horticulturist is 888-755-6377. 888-755-6377. You can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, like Mo in Sydney, Montana did. She has reached out to you before, Ron, so I'm handing you the printed attachment of some photos that she sent.
All
about
the way from Montana?
About her bur oak. You've previously answered a couple questions about branches that seem to be competing with the main stem, and you advised her to wait to trim or to have an arborist do this in the fall. Mm-hmm. The problem is the closest arborist that she knows of is 4 hours from Sydney. Wondering if you can advise best way to prune the tree. Is it cutting the lower branches off the trunk or anything past the sub-branches? And she wants to know how to do this.
This is going to have to be judgment on her part. First of all, make sure she has some good pruning tools. Okay, sharp tools, not stuff that's going to have to cause some twisting. So looking at the photos that you sent me, probably a pair of hand loppers, the long-handled loppers will suffice. Pick out what you want to be your main trunk and then prune back to that main trunk, all the lower branches as the season goes on. Let the green leaves stay on as long as possible because if they're green, they're making photosynthates, which is food for the plant, which is going into the root system and the crown, and it'll come back a lot stronger next year. So let it stay there until we see the leaves turn yellow or brown or drop off. A bur oak is probably just going to be a yellow or a brown foliage. Then go back in and cut right back to where the main trunk is. Okay. I know a lot of people say, you got to wait until spring to do that. Basically, with a bur oak, they're as tough as a crowbar. They aren't going to be bothered by pruning at this time of year. And she can see where she wants the tree to grow with the multiple branches out there. Go ahead and do it so that you don't get the snow load that I'm sure she gets out there in Montana breaking those branches off.
All right. She can design her own tree, right?
Yeah, absolutely she can. And it'll turn out to be a beautiful tree. It's off to a good start. Seems to be quite ambitious. As far as its overall growth goes, she just needs to give it a little bit of direction, just like any other teenager.
And we were reminded that, Montana is very dry, too,
yes.
And it's very hot out there. Mm-hmm. They've got forest fires going everywhere. Yep. Danielle mentioned that in the newscast.
Mm-hmm. And give it a little bit of water. Yeah. Don't be afraid. Don't let it go into the winter months without any water, by all means. Yeah, give it a shot of water.
Well, here's a question. About a week ago, a bug appeared on the underside of a peace lily. So we're moving inside. It's red with black markings, possibly a caterpillar. There are several other varieties of plants on the windowsill, but the bug is not eating them. With this limited information, would you be able to identify this unwelcome visitor and explain how it was able to enter the house and crawl into a large flower pot on a wide windowsill?
Oh, gosh.
Detective?
Yes, detective. Yes, I'll put on my detective hat and overcoat, play Columbo, you're too young to know who Columbo is, aren't you, Ashley?
It was a TV show.
It was? Oh, yes. Your mother told you about it, right? Anyway, what likely happened, and this is one of the things that we have to go through at our house, in the Smith house, we have some plants, house plants that we have outside, and we make absolutely sure that they're as clean as a whistle when we bring them inside, because nothing that my wife or I abhor more, like, where did this crazy insect come from that's flying around our house, inside of our house. So what probably happened is that the moth or a beetle or whatever it was laid eggs on the foliage or at the base of the plant, and you brought it inside, it hatched, and it became, like any other young developing organism, became a voracious eater. And so, the only thing I can tell you to do is you can go ahead and fumigate it if you want to. You can go ahead and, on a nice day, set it outside and then spray it with an insecticide, a systemic insecticide, something that will be taken up by the roots of the plant and into the vascular system of the plant. So if anything else is in there that you didn't see or hasn't hatched yet, begins to feed on it, it's doomsday for it.
Well, if you've got a question for horticulturist Ron Smith, it's easy to ask it. He's in the studio right now. Give us a call at 888-755-6377. That's 888-755-6377. Or you can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
We have a question about a lilac hedge. Every summer, the leaves are turning pale and whitish. Are they lacking a fertilizer?
Well, probably not. Lilacs are pretty tough plants, but they're very prone to a mild fungus called powdery mildew that shows up around this time of the year. And, you can prevent this from happening by applying a fungicide that's specific for showing or for controlling powdery mildew. But since it's showing up at this time of year, it's not going to make that much difference. It's not going to hurt anything as far as the plant goes. So I would just really forget about it. Don't spend your money on fungicides. Simply just observe it when the leaves drop, pick them up. Maybe examine a little bit of pruning possibilities of the plant to help increase air circulation there. That would cut down on powdery mildew. Powdery mildew will develop where you get stagnant or stale air, high dew point temperatures where you get the moisture staying on the leaves, free moisture on the leaves, and that causes powdery mildew to go ahead and develop.
It just looks bad. It doesn't hurt the plant.
Nah, it's like you and I going a day without shaving.
Uh-oh.
Or are you getting
Wait,
to get
that
a beard
looks
started?
Pretty bad.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there's no mildew on it yet.
The number to call is 888-755-6377. We have a caller on the line. John is calling in from Dickinson.
Hi, John.
Hey, hi. How are you doing?
Great.
I've got a question for you. Mm-hmm. I planted about 60 hackberry trees. They were about 6-8 inches tall this spring, late spring, mm-hmm. and about the same number of Colorado blue spruce.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there's anything I should do to give them a better chance to overwinter.
Yes. Have you put any kind of an organic mulch around the base of these trees?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one of the first things I would suggest doing to both of your Colorado blue spruce and your hackberries would be to get some organic mulch. You can buy it, or you can, if you have anybody that's grinding up a tree that hasn't, just dead, doesn't have any pronounced disease problems on it, you can go ahead and put that around the base of the tree, but not up against the trunk of the of either of these trees, and that'll help to mitigate the wide swings of temperature that the typically Dickinson goes through, as well as the rest of the state. But you guys out there are a little bit drier, so if you get a sudden drop in temperature down to 25 degrees below zero, and those roots don't have a mulch protecting them at this early stage in planting, you've planted them this past spring, they are more likely to be winter killed without that mulch. So 2 to 4 inches, no more. Don't make a mulch volcano. Don't say if 4 inches is good, 8 inches have got to be twice as good. That's not proper. that's poor thinking, you know. That's like one piece of chocolate cake is good, but two pieces is not.
Better.
Not.
No.
as far as mice or rabbits or anything like that?
Yeah, you got to protect those. Rabbits usually don't go after hackberries. They're usually pretty tough. They have other preferences in your landscape. But knowing rabbits and having fought them ferociously most of my life here in North Dakota, they might just decide, well, the heck with it. My favorite dish isn't here. I'm going to go ahead and on these things. You can get tree wrap to put around it. It's either a poly type of tree wrap that you can spring on to the trunks of the trees, or you can get some cloth that you can go ahead and wrap around the trunk of the trees to put it on there. Okay. Then also spray with a rabbit repellent and get that done as soon as you possibly can. Get that rabbit repellent sprayed onto the tree and do it about every 3 or 4 weeks to keep those little bounders away.
And the spruce are not vulnerable to rabbits?
They aren't supposed to be. I've lived.
Tell that to the rabbits.
Yeah, I've seen rabbits nibble on spruce as well. And, I go up to these guys and I say, what are you doing? You're not supposed to eat those things. They don't pay any attention to me. No, they are not supposed to. But I'd go ahead and spray the foliage of your young spruce as well because, I'd hate to have you call me back and say, Ron, they ate all my spruce. So don't trust a rabbit.
Thank you, John.
Very good.
Thanks for
your
call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome,
bye-bye.
Sir. Bye-bye.
If you've got a question for our horticulturist, it's easy to ask it, 888-755-6377. And we'll be back with Ron Smith in just a moment.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
Thousands of families affected by disasters urgently need your support. You can help the American Red Cross provide warm meals, shelter, and hope to families when they need it most. Please join North Dakota State University Performing Arts and the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra for a benefit concert at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall at 2 p.m. Sunday, September 17th. Free will donations will be accepted with 100% going directly to Red Cross Disaster Relief to help those affected by 2017 hurricanes in the United States.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and horticulturist Ron Smith. He's in the studio taking your questions, and people are calling.
Absolutely, because it's an easy process, and it's free to you. 888-755-6377, just like George in Bismarck. Thanks
Hi.
For calling.
Hi, George.
Hey, Ron. Thanks for taking my call.
Gladly.
You've probably answered this question 1,000 times, but I've never heard the answer, and so I'm asking, what do you do with tomato mold that has recurred for the last 3 or 4 years in my garden?
Tomato mold?
You know, where the leaves get shrivel up and the plant basically dies. It produces tomatoes.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, welcome to the club, because a lot of tomatoes at this time of year are showing those symptoms exactly, and it could be from any one of three leaf spot diseases, fungal and bacterial leaf spot diseases. The best way to prevent that is to use drip irrigation, or don't water overhead, or if you have to water overhead, make sure you do it in the early part of the day so that they dry, the foliage dries. The other thing you can do is be scrupulous, hospital operating room clean at getting the dead tomato plants out this fall, making sure there's no leaf residue there this fall. And then don't plant the tomatoes in the same spot next year. Plant them in a different spot. You want to get into some crop rotation. And to get into crop rotation, you shouldn't plant anything in the tomato family. No peppers, no eggplant. to follow that crop. So if you go from tomatoes, you can go to sweet corns, you can go to cabbage, you can go to string beans, you can go to lettuce, parsley, chives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just don't plant tomatoes again. The biggest thing is to look for cultivars that are resistant to these leaf spot diseases. I don't know what varieties you're planting, but generally the new hybrids are the ones that are the most resistant. Now, resistance does not equal immunity, okay? So if you don't follow good irrigation practices, keeping the moisture off the leaves on a regular basis and watering in the early part of the day so that the leaves have a chance to dry out if you have to water overhead, you're going to end up with that fungus. But, you know, look at it this way. You're getting tomatoes anyway. I know we're going to go home. When I go home today, I'm going to go home to hamburgers on the grill, sweet corn on the grill, and then the hamburgers are going to be dressed with cheese, tomatoes, and peppers from our garden.
You may be followed home, Ron.
Yeah. Well, did that help you, George?
Yeah, very much. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for your call.
You bet.
She just mentioned to our listeners out there that this show airs at 3 o'clock Central, typically Monday through Friday. We rebroadcast at 7 p.m. So if you're trying to call, it's after 7. We've gone home. We're at Ron's place. We're having a
eating hamburgers, right? But you can send an email.
You can always send an email. Mm-hmm. Yes, to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Or if you are calling live during this afternoon broadcast, that number, 888-755-6377. I have an email question wondering if it is too early in the season to trim peonies down to the ground.
Oh, I know. You're sick and tired of looking at them. But yes, it is. It's a little bit early. I'd wait until we had a good, hard, killing frost. And my wife is trying to encourage an early frost with her wishes. And, of course, Mother Nature is not cooperating. Well, she's tired of the insects, the yellow jackets, the mosquitoes.
Your wife and I are going to have a talk.
Okay, yeah. She's a pretty stubborn person, I can guarantee it. So,
my people are Scandinavian.
Okay, well, she's pretty close to that. She's German, so tough heads being hit there. But no, it's one of those, I would wait until we had a good hard frost and then go ahead and cut them down.
And that's typically later in September?
Well,
it can be any time.
Any time. It could be 48 hours from now, 72 hours from now, or it could be the end of October around Halloween.
Well, that would be different.
Yes. And my wife would be, she would be complaining.
Speaking of hard frost, are we getting within that deadline then of stuff that needs to be planted in the fall? Do we really need to be getting that done this weekend?
Well,
I know it's a moving target, but pretty soon,
yes. Yeah. The soil, keep in mind, no matter what the temperature of the air is, it's the soil temperature that's going to make a big difference. So as long as that soil temperature stays at 40 degrees or above, where are you planting that? That plant's going to be okay. It's not going to look good on the top. Okay, but is it going to look good? It's going to be all right as far as being established goes. So that's why you plant in the fall. You're not getting this top growth that's going to go limp on you because you didn't quite handle it quite right and you didn't get enough water on it just at the right time. At this time of the year, it's not going to make that much difference. You're just going to get it established. The root system is going to need moisture, and you have that temperature at 40-plus degrees. The roots are going to be active until it gets below.
The Horticulturist is in at Main Street, and you can give us a call at 888-755-6377 or email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, and we'll be back with our expert after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Xcel Energy says it has made substantial progress in making electrical system improvements in Fargo. Xcel's Mark Nesbitt says the CapEx transmission line, which runs from the Monticello nuclear plant in Minnesota to the Mapleton substation, has helped with reliability. Nesbitt says the utility has also installed intelligent switches to reroute power in case of an outage. And he says it has changed its tree trimming protocol to help prevent branches from falling on power lines and causing outages.
We've also made the first strides towards bringing a new loop in from our Maple River to Red River substation. We're getting the planning done on that. That'll be a $20 million project that would truly give us more flexibility and more options to keep the lights on around town.
The Red River substation serves North Fargo. Nesbitt says Xcel has filed the necessary paperwork and plans for that new loop. Over the past several years, Fargo customers have complained about the number of power outages. The pending retirement of Grand Forks School Superintendent Larry Nydblad sparked debate last night as school board members wrestled with the financial package associated with his leaving. Nydblad plans to step down as the district boss next June. His contract calls for him to be paid for unused sick and vacation time. In addition, Nydblad qualifies for the district's early retirement program. Board member Megan Sandy says that comes at a cost to the district, over $35,000 in each of the next 4 years.
Our superintendent is the highest paid in the state. The next behind him is paid $20,000 less per year.
Board President Doug Carpenter says the language in the superintendent's contract should not come as a surprise. It was approved by the board.
We can debate at what I think would some other time would be much more appropriate, whether the superintendent or directors or other administrative staff or principals or even teachers should be entitled to early retirement. I don't think this is an appropriate time to discuss whether there should be early retirement for one or not. That should have been a policy decision.
The board approved the early retirement 7-1. Nyblad will remain on the job through June, and the board will also hire a search firm to attract potential new candidates for the job. And gates opened this morning, for the 37th annual Big Iron Farm Show. The Ag Expo takes place in West Fargo and once again will be host to a delegation of international farm equipment buyers.
You know, the typical Eurasian countries, of Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan. And then again, like last year, there's quite a large delegation from Africa, from several different countries in Africa. They're looking to modernize their agriculture, and they've decided Big Iron is a good place to go to help do that.
Dean Gorder is executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. He says this year has 75 visitors from 15 different countries in attendance. Gorder says over 200 people had originally registered to attend, but due to complications, not everyone was able to secure a visa.
It's unclear at this point as to what drives it. You know, for good reason, you know, they're tight with visas, and I understand that. And I think it's just a matter of education within the State Department to understand what we are offering here and then help them approve more people.
Gorder says the delegates able to attend will be looking to buy new and used equipment, parts for existing equipment, as well as take field tours and tour companies that manufacture farm equipment. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
And welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Ron Smith, our horticulturist. And, of course, you out there are participating today. Give us a call, 888-755-6377, or email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And here is an email question from Mary in Bismarck. I have a question about bittersweet. She says, I planted both male and female plants a few years ago along a fence and had some beautiful berries for a year or two. In the last 3 years, I've had no berries. The plant is overgrown and tends to take over everything. Should I cut both plants down to the ground so that I have new growth next year? Would this make a difference with whether it flowers and has fall berries next year?
Oh, those are some good questions. let me think about that for a second here. And while I think, I'll talk. How about that? bittersweet, yeah, the male and female plants are needed in order to get berries to be produced on the female. Now, my question is, are you sure that you have the two male and female plants there, or has the female taken over and the male has died out? That could very well be. Or has the female died and just the male plant is there?
How do you know?
I have no idea. You just have to take a look at the flower, and I don't know that much about bittersweet flowers to say X is this and Y is that. So I really don't know. Your idea, cut them down, Mary, to the ground this fall and see what comes back this next spring. And then try to take them if you can. If they start to flower, if you see any flowers at all on them, try to take them to the county agent there and see if he or she can get them identified for you as far as this is a male flower or this is a female flower or they're both males or they're both female flowers.
Do they have to be adjacent to each other or can
well,
they be within, a distance
within
away?
Within the yard.
Okay.
Yeah, the same property. I mean, they don't have to be, you know, intertwined with each other.
But okay.
The closer they are, the more intimate they can get.
There you go.
The old sex story, right?
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. So, yeah. Yeah, they do have a tendency to take over everything once you get them going. So they are going to need some control pruning there at some point. 3 years, no berries. I'd be concerned that you just have one of the species left, one of the genders left there.
888-755-6377 is the number to call during this afternoon broadcast. Or if you're listening in the evening, you can also send an email, mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We have a question about plants. Appears to be wild asparagus. How do you know if it really is asparagus? And if not, what might it be? When is the best time to harvest it, and can it be transplanted to a garden?
Okay. Well, asparagus is asparagus, and they can be transplanted after a good hard frost like most things can. And so I would suggest that you wait and till we get that good hard frost in your location and go ahead and transplant them and then decide next spring whether or not you have wild or domesticated asparagus.
So there's no way to know, though. Will be asparagus in the spring, or it'll be something else. So
the thing I would caution people about, we tried for years to grow asparagus in our backyard with very, very limited success. And then all of a sudden it became very successful. Very successful. Very successful. And it got to the point where we had the ferns were just taking over everything, and it made the backyard look ugly. And I decided it wasn't worth having the asparagus spears there for that fern that you had to go ahead and put up with afterwards. And we had the little berries that came on the asparagus ferns that just dropped off, and we had asparagus popping up here, there, and everywhere, which were just little sprigs of asparagus and not anything worthwhile. And so I went to go ahead and dig them out. And asparagus crowns and roots are close to being one of the top 10 difficult root systems to dig out of your garden. So think very carefully before you decide you want to have an asparagus patch. And the same thing with a raspberry patch, because they do require constant maintenance and constant attention. And if you don't like what they want to do, you're going to have to be out there managing it and, you know, wrestling with it to get them to both stay in line. So I'm just saying, think about this carefully. If you love asparagus, you don't mind working them, you're young, nimble, and like challenges, go ahead and do it. And the same thing with raspberries.
And you could have a lot of asparagus.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, here's the number to call, 888-755-6377, or email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Here's a question about a raspberry patch. I have a large raspberry patch that is out of control and in need of pruning. Mm-hmm. I plan on cutting a path lengthwise to make two rows. I also would like to trim the tops and sides. What do you think of my plan, and how much should I cut off at one time? The plants are healthy and produced a lot of berries this year.
Oh, boy. Well, raspberries they would be considered weeds if they didn't produce the fruit, okay? They grow like weeds. At least it's been my experience when I had them back in New York State 100 years ago, and they were the same way in my backyard and my neighbor's backyard. And so they do have a tendency to resist being killed. I mean, he can go ahead and take a rototiller and run down the middle of his raspberry patch, hack those things back as far as he wants to, and he's going to get plenty of raspberry plants growing next spring. I can assure him of that.
And it won't be hard to do that? I mean, what's the root system to a raspberry plant like?
Well, it's tenacious.
Yeah.
It's weak. It's determined. It spreads by rhizomes. And that's why if you have a...
So is that near the surface?
Near the surface. So you can get in there with a tiller and till it down. And, yes, pull out the roots that you tore up. Don't worry about the stuff on the side. Trim those back the way you want to, and you're probably still going to have some coming up where you till it up, okay? Those little sprigs, those little pieces of raspberries are almost like little pieces of rhizomes from quackgrass. Mm-hmm. And you leave a one-inch piece of raspberry rhizome in the soil is going to turn into a little raspberry plant.
That sounds like a neat idea he's got, though. He's making it more accessible to get
banana. Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. You can either do what we tried to do here in Fargo or do what my sister did up in Calgary. She planted them in the corner of her house and just let the bush grow, put some string around the bush so it doesn't hang over into the yard where they want to mow, and she just stands in one spot and picks from this monstrous bush plenty of raspberries.
Delicious.
Yeah. She looks for the easy way out and is very successful.
888-755-6377 is the number to call. We do have time for a couple more calls. In the meantime, we have an email from Lowell in Bismarck, and I'm handing you a picture of a plant that he said, this plant was very green and bushy 2 weeks ago to the point that it was out of control. So he trimmed it with a scissors, and in the last couple weeks, it has turned all brown and looks pretty unhappy. Hmm. Wants to know if he killed his plant. So can you identify that plant for starters?
In my younger days, I probably could because I was more into houseplants than I am now. But I don't want to take a wild guess, but I like the cartoon he has.
Yeah, he did draw a picture of a sad face.
Yeah, sad face there. I doubt that he's killed it just by pruning with some scissors. He must have done something else. I'm just guessing that watered it was too cold, or water was too cold, or something else happened with a plant, because I can't bring myself to believe that pruning it with some scissors would kill the plant.
Water was too cold. Help me with that one.
Well, the most houseplants are tropical.
Yeah.
And in the wintertime, cold water is very cold. With our 90-degree heat that we've had pretty much all summer, the cold water isn't very cold. Now, it's not hot enough or not warm enough, I should say, for you to take a cold shower. It would still make you yell and jump out of the shower, but it could be a shock to the plant. I don't know how cold it really is, to tell you the truth, but it could be cold enough to shock the plant into going into a depressed state like his sketch shows right here. But where is he from? Where did this
In come? Bismarck, yeah.
In Bismarck. Mm-hmm. I take that over to the local county office there, either there in Bismarck or over to Mandan, and ask them to take a look at it, because there could be something else going on there, too.
Well, and in an office setting, too, you never know about your colleagues.
Well, yeah, they're liable to.
Might be some coffee in that.
Yeah, find out who your enemies are. Yeah, coffee shouldn't do any harm to it, but if they pour it on when it's scalding hot, that could be a problem. So,
okay. Here's a question from Southern Manitoba. They have 25 trees. They have access to a large water source, but the water is relatively salty.
Mm-hmm.
Is this water okay to use for soaking the trees for winter? Our soil is a mix of clay, sand, and loam. We haven't had any rain for a month, so I'm concerned the salty water will hurt the trees.
Well, if they have a mix of sand, clay, and loam, it should be okay. If they have just clay, then the salts are going to accumulate in the soil and not percolate through. So he needs to have the water tested to see what the degree of salinity is there. And then perhaps, if he can, try to alternate his normal watering with some RO water or distilled water to help flush the salts through if he's having problems with it accumulating, especially in clay soils.
Well, 25 trees, that's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, yes. They should be, you know, he didn't say how old the trees are. If they're old, they probably have gotten pretty well established. If they are young transplants, that's going to be the most critical time for them. Because the older they get, the more tolerant they seem to develop. They develop the tolerance of their immediate environment better so than young trees that you'd put in there that, you know, greenhouse grown or nursery grown under ideal conditions, and you plop them in this salty environment, then they're going to suddenly say, this isn't the way I was raised. You know, I'm not going to go ahead and perform the way you want. So they're going to be very pouty, very weak, and maybe even just up and die.
You know, we don't get many calls from Florida, but there's this hurricane that just went up the whole state and caused these storm surges, which is ocean water, that's salt water, that went over what would be, you know, lawns and gardens and all kinds of stuff. So if you were in Florida right now, what would you be thinking?
Well, I'd be taking pills to get over the depression of what happened to me, or something, drinking something, or find something to get over it. But as far as the plants go, with the salty media, the whole peninsula is supposedly very, very salt, or excuse me, very sandy soil. And even though seawater has a high salt, if it can move on through the soil profile, it's not going to be bad. And if they can follow up in a few weeks with some fresh water to flush those salts out, no harm is done.
And they probably get a fair amount of rain. Anyway.
And rain coming in anyway will help that quite a bit. So that would be a good thing.
We have an email question that is about dandelions and other weeds in the lawn. Here, someone in Gackle says, I hear that the fall is the best time to control the weeds. Is it too dry to do any good this fall? What is the best way to fight dandelions?
Well, yes, it's probably too dry if they haven't watered. If they want to fight their dandelions this fall, then they need to go out there and, take good care of their dandelions in their lawn. Water them. Give them about a week of water, every other day to soften them up, get them growing again, get them coming out of the stubborn, bulletproof dormancy that they're in.
You're going to fool these dandelions. Huh?
Yes, and then go ahead and put your herbicide down, or have somebody that knows what they're doing put the herbicide down, and you'll get a very, very effective kill. This is the best time to do it because you're not getting surge growth. You're getting assimilative growth. The carbohydrates that the dandelion leaves are making are going into the crown and the root system of the plant and not producing any new growth or flowers. So this is a good time, but she needs to do something to soften them up a little bit, pamper them, make them feel like they're loved, by giving them ample water.
You are ruthless.
I know, I'm getting gross. Okay. Who loves dandelions, right?
I do. They're delicious.
Here's another question.
Good for your liver.
We have three autumn blaze maples in our yard. They can be gorgeous. Two of them are really beautiful, and they were planted 15 years ago. The other tree was planted about 5 years ago. The younger tree died during the last 2 years. Mm. We suspect we didn't water it enough. Mm. The bark on the west and south side of the dead tree is cracked and peeling off. One of the older trees looks healthy, but also has pretty extensive bark peeling on the west side from the ground to the lower branches. Both of these trees are exposed to west and south sun and wind. Mm-hmm. That direction seems to be important. We've been very dry and hot here for the last two summers. Our winters have been mild. Our other older tree is on the east side of the house and shaded from the west sunlight. Does not appear to have the bark peeling issue. We're concerned that our older tree is in danger and wondering what we can do. This came in from Kansas.
Okay. Well, yes, they very aptly describe the symptoms of drought and heat stress. That's a perfect description that you'll find on that right there. One of the things, and I think Skip's going to probably have to do his magic with his computer, is to see if you can buy what they call water bags. And these are bags that you can put around the stem of the tree. They can hold 15 gallons, and they allow, water percolates through coffee grounds. They have a porous bottom to them. And the water can go ahead and drip down around the base there, and you fill it up about once a week to keep that soil moist around the base of the tree, and that will help keep them alive and help keep them from being stressed. The company that does that is DeWitt, DeWitt. And I know if Skip can look it up on his computer. No, he can't. Okay.
We've got 1 minute left. We're going to squeeze in one last phone call from Royce, who's calling in a little bit west of Mandan.
Hi, Royce.
Hi. Hey, I planted a couple thousand square feet of buffalo grass.
Oh, good.
And the buffalo grass actually happens to be on top of an earth shelter. I put new black topsoil on it and raked it in. A month ago, and the buffalo grass is about an inch and a half high now, but there are a couple thousand square feet of grass there, but there are probably 5,000 weeds in it, and mostly ragweed, and it's going to seed.
Mm-hmm. And what's your question?
What can he do to control his ragweed,
okay.
right?
Yeah.
Right.
Wait until the buffalo grass goes dormant and then go out and try to attack your ragweed and other weeds as as judiciously as you possibly can. The old magic of waiting until a hard frost puts your buffalo grass into dormancy will help keep it from being damaged by a broadleaf herbicide.
Okay.
That's as quick an answer as I can give you.
And we've run up against the clock. Thank you, Royce.
Appreciate it. You don't think I should use a herbicide on it, huh?
Not right now, no. I assume it's still growing and green.
Okay.
Green.
We've got to run, Royce. I'm sorry for that. But, you know, we had some calls today, and the horticulture is always a pleasure to have Ron Smith.
Likewise to be here. It's great.
More Main Street in a moment.
There are pub crawls. Those are fun. Even zombie crawls. Those are a little scary. And here's one that's fun and educational.
I'll show you how to put some of nature's masterpieces right here on the canvas.
Studio Crawls. It's one of the best events in the Red River Valley area, and it's free. The FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6 p.m.
It's going to sparkle us.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists.
Lately, I've been painting with a lot of metallic paints.
You know, you go to a museum to look at the art.
The juxtaposition of color is amazing.
Well, you can go on the studio crawl to look at the artists. Go ahead, they won't bite. See painters, potters, sculptors, a glassblower, all demonstrating their work and talking with you about their lives as working artists.
Just work all the time.
Yes, you can be a working artist, not just a starving artist. Get your studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/events. The FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Gutes Essen, Good Eating in German-Russian Country, is the newest in a series of Prairie Public documentaries about immigrants who came to North Dakota in the 1880s. The show, with lots of local color and recipes, premiered last Thursday on our television service. Today, we offer a short excerpt featuring Cleo Boshi talking about sauerkraut days in Wishick.
I'm Cleo Boshi. I'm a resident of Wishick, North Dakota. This is our 91st one. It's always been free to the public, which is one of the things people that come from out of state to attend this. Well, where do we buy the ticket? This is free. Well, there aren't a lot of free things today, I guess, anymore. You know, it was something that the business people wanted to do just to kind of say thank you to their people that patronized them and purchased most of their supplies right here in town. Normally we have about 1,500 people that turn out for this event. You noticed all the politicians we had there today, they all get a chance to kind of toot their own horn a little bit and say a few things about it. Wishick is a great community. We're 100 miles from, we say, everywhere. We call ourselves the sauerkraut capital of the nation. 500 pounds of wieners, 110 gallons of sauerkraut, 200 pounds of speck, which is fat. That's just some of the food that they serve, and probably very little left over. Our music instructor, you notice she's got the kids playing accordion, and that's kind of a dying art. We're a small school. There's only 200 and probably 20 students in the entire school. And you saw the group today, I mean, the band and the choir, they were singing German songs, playing polka music. I mean, it fits right into our heritage. Right now, we're in the Baptist church here, and they have a pie social every time that we have sauerkraut days here. They're all made by the women of the church here. Oh, yeah, that's why they're so good. And so you can see it draws quite a crowd. You know, we've got a lot of recognition from this, not only in the local community, but all over. And people just, they put that on their calendar. It's the second Wednesday of October. And if anybody wants to come next year, that's when it's going to be. I've gotten to know a lot of people just from sauerkraut day. They come in, and next year they come back, and they give you a hug, and you shake their hand, and they say, well, you remember us, you know, and which is, you know, kind of nice.
You can watch Gutes Essen, Good Eating in German-Russian Country in its entirety when it's rebroadcast on Saturday, September 16th at 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. Central Time. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 12th. North Dakota remembers World War I. Until the end of summer in 1917, the war was still somewhat impersonal for most North Dakotans. Many young men seeking adventure had joined in the early months of the war, but most communities were not affected, and deaths were few. Those who enlisted over the summer had departed as individuals or in small groups amid the fanfare of patriotic celebrations. The main units of the North Dakota National Guard were still stationed within the boundaries of the state. With few North Dakotans in harm's way, the war was more of an inconvenience. Rationing had not yet become a part of everyday life, but people were asked to conserve most resources. For many, it was not until the first call of draftees that the reality of war was brought home. These men were being stripped from the community, and their destiny became tied to the battlefields of Europe. Many were married with young families, and many were nurturing careers. Plans were postponed, and families would now wait anxiously for their return. Now that the draft selection was almost complete, the time had come to begin moving the massive numbers of men. Only 5% of the assigned quota was initially called up. Once they subtracted credits for those who enlisted or were members of the National Guard, North Dakota's share was only 90 men statewide. On the 6th of September, Cass County's quota of 18 men boarded the special Northern Pacific train at Fargo, containing three sleeper cars, en route to Camp Dodge, Iowa. Several thousand people, including units of the National Guard, jammed the avenues leading to the train station. Among the tears and good cheers, the Cass County men joined their fellow draftees who had boarded at stations further west. On this date in 1917, another much larger contingent of draftees, numbering almost 2,000 men, was notified to prepare for mobilization. The Women's Christian Temperance Union provided each man with a comfort kit. It was a bag of approximately 10 by 13 inches with a drawstring on the top. The contents included needles, thread, and other sewing goods, as well as shaving soap, regular soap, toothpaste, a toothbrush, a small mirror, a pocket knife, and shoelaces. The WCTU was a strong advocate for abolishing the use of tobacco, so it was ironic that nearby the Fargo Forum was collecting funds to provide tobacco kits, another of the comforts from home. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hurricane Irma left millions in Florida without electricity, and the storm flooded towns across the state.
There's some significant house damage there. We saw some more trailer homes that were heavily damaged and a number of boats that had been tossed about, some still in the water and some thrown up on land.
Now some residents are returning home, but to what? Assessing the aftermath of Irma and what it will take to rebuild. That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, better known as DACA. The legal status of the young immigrants who are known as Dreamers is in doubt, and immigration attorney Anna Stenson will join us on Wednesday to discuss some of the issues that arise from their predicament. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.